I hope that all of you back on Earth can see what we mean when we say it's a rather foreboding horizon, a rather dark and unappetizing looking place. We're now going over approaching one of our future landing sites selected in this smooth region to call the Sea of Tranquility. Smooth in order to make it easy for the initial landing attempt in order to preclude having to dodge mountains. Now you can see the long shadows of the lunar sunrise.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. You just heard a transmission from Apollo 8 astronaut Frank Borman on December 24, 1968. He's describing the first views of what would be the Apollo 11 landing site less than a year later. I was 8 years old when Apollo 8 astronauts Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders became the first human beings to leave the Earth's gravitational well and orbit the moon. The year 1968 was, by any accounts, a terrible one in the United States. The war in Vietnam took an alarming turn when the North Vietnamese launched the Tet Offensive in January. On April 4th, NASA launched a test of the moon rocket, the Saturn V, which did not go well at all. The vehicle nearly shook itself to pieces, but that didn't make the news because on that day, Martin Luther King was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. I'll never forget what happened in June when my father pulled over the car near our L.A. home to tell me that Robert F. Kennedy had died after being shot in the Ambassador Hotel. He had just won the California primary. Riots in Chicago turned the Democratic Convention into a chaotic mess later that summer. The Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia in August in a bloody Iron Curtain crackdown. It was a horrible year, and as a child, I was aware of it. But then NASA announced that it would send the second flight of Apollo after the successful test flight of Apollo 7 in Earth orbit to the moon at Christmas. It was, without a doubt, NASA's boldest move during the pioneering era of space exploration. Three Americans would be the first human beings to see the far side of the moon with their own warm, moist eyeballs. And it would happen all on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I didn't really think of it then, but I know now that it was an incredibly dangerous mission, and had it failed, Christmas would have been ruined for our country, and possibly three astronauts would be entombed in eternal orbit to this day, perhaps ruining the beauty of the moon forever for many of us. But it didn't fail. It was a spectacular success, and as we'll hear, it literally saved 1968. Time magazine thought so. They named Borman, Lovell, and Anders their persons of the year. Their photograph, Earthrise, taken on that Christmas Eve, was called by nature photographer Galen Roll the most influential environmental photograph ever taken. In this program, we'll hear about the mission from its finest chronicler, Time Magazine's Jeffrey Kluger, the author of Apollo 8, who has worked closely with the three astronauts to tell their story 50 years later. And a man who was there in mission control throughout the most historic missions of the 1960s and early 70s, flight controller Glenn Lunny. He joins us from his home in Houston to talk about what it was like to be there in mission control on that dramatic Christmas holiday 50 years ago. So trim your tree with us while we look back at Apollo 8's mission to the moon at Christmas. We are joined by Jeffrey Kluger, author of Apollo 8 and Time Magazine science editor. He joins us via Skype from Time's offices in New York City. Jeffrey Kluger, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
And of course, we're doing this show because it's the 50th anniversary, boy, I can't believe that, of the Apollo 8 mission coming up here in December.
Yeah, half a century ago. It's in one sense, it's extraordinary to think of what we've accomplished. In another sense, it's a little dispiriting to think that it's been so long that since we were actually at or on or around the moon. But that's a different conversation, I think.
Yeah, it's been a long, long time since 1972, since humans have been in deep space. You know, this is a big deal, and you know, we were hoping. I know you're pretty good friends with all three of the astronauts, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders. Did you bring any of them with you?
I would tell you if I did. If there was anybody sitting in the room with me right now, I would love to surprise you with a voice. Alas, these guys are being inundated with requests for interviews, for appearances. They turned down the BBC. I have no idea how many other people they've turned down. We did manage to, Time Magazine did manage to catch up with them at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago in October. And we had the opportunity to interview them and photograph them in front of the Apollo 8 spacecraft, which was pretty exciting to see the same three guys, you know, within a handful of feet of the spacecraft they piloted around the moon. It was something of a thrill.
Well, let's talk about Apollo 8, you know, against the backdrop of 1968 with the assassinations, the riots, everything going on. This is only about a year after the Apollo 1 fire has killed the astronauts Grissom, White, and Chaffee. And then there's only one test flight, Apollo 7. And then this decision to send Apollo 8 to the moon. I would like you to talk about the machinations of what went into, you know, the background, because I found it fascinating, of Chris Kraft and the people in Houston coming up with this plan to go to the moon and then having to sell that to Jim Webb and Robert Mueller, who was the top administrators, I believe.
Right. And it was equal parts audacious, political, and just plain smart engineering. The audacious and political part, of course, was that, you know, as you said, 1968 was an explosively unhappy year. And I think the idea of being able to end it with this great national redemption was something of a thrill. And it was hard even for hard-headed, very practical, sometimes cynical engineers and administrators not to see that possibility. But that was low on their list. The geopolitical considerations were considerable. It was right around that time that the CIA had gotten word that the Soviets were planning to launch their Zond spacecraft with a single cosmonaut on a circumlunar trip around the far side of the moon. And they, in fact, did test two of them, Zond 5 and Zond 6, with animals as preliminary cargo inside. Both of the spacecraft did get around the far side of the moon and came back. Neither landed safely, however. But the U.S. knew none of this. They just knew that Russia was very close. The Soviet Union was very close to launching a cosmonaut around the far side of the moon. So that was, you know, the Cold War superpower competition piece. The bigger issue, though, was that in a strange way, this audacious mission was also the most practical and sensible mission they could fly. The lunar module was supposed to have been ready by the time Apollo 8 flew, well, before Apollo 8 flew, actually. So once Apollo 7 flew and tested the command module in Earth orbit, Apollo 8 was going to test the lunar module and the command module in Earth orbit, and then Apollo 9 was going to do the same flight, but just at a higher altitude. But the LEM wasn't ready. So what NASA was considering was, what can we do to advance the program? What can we do in the time we're waiting for the LEM to be ready to get more experience, to get some greater aptitude at flying the spacecraft we do have, which was just the command service module? And the decision was made, well, we could take this thing to the moon. We can just do some of what we've been trying to do, but do it out of order. Instead of testing the command module and then the lunar module together in Earth orbit, take what we have, do the lunar part, get out to the moon, go circumlunar, come home, and then test the LEM in Earth orbit. It's out of order, but you're completing, you're checking boxes on your list. Now, what truly made it both harrowing but technologically sensible was that rather than simply going circumlunar, whipping around the far side of the moon and taking a free return trajectory ride home, they decided to go into lunar orbit because as long as they were there, they should map the moon, and they should also test the gravitational, the irregular gravity of the moon, to determine what influence that would have on later landings. And that was the part that was, it radically increased the danger of the mission, because there was always a risk of the astronauts getting trapped in lunar orbit. But it dramatically increased the yield of the mission, because if they went out there and stayed for 10 orbits instead of just whipping around the far side, they could gather a lot more data for future missions.
And let's talk a bit about the crew. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of these three extraordinary men who are still, you know, still alive and healthy, and as you said, just, you know, posed for pictures with the command module there in Chicago, and are going to be so much in demand, I'm sure, in the next month. Tell us a bit about Borman, Lovell, and Anders.
Well, they are three very different men. They remain three very different men. And they flew their mission in three very different ways for three different reasons. Borman was very much a patriot. They were all patriots, but Borman was very much a patriot and a soldier and a cold warrior. And he saw this as one more battle in that war. He had trained to as a military fighter pilot and had very much wanted to fight in Korea, but an eardrum injury grounded him for a period of time. And when he finally was back in the flight rotation, his class had already been tapped for most of the combat assignments, and the Air Force was going for younger men for the next classes to come along. So he, I think, always felt that he had missed his opportunity to step into the breach and fight for his country. And to him, Apollo 8 was that. He wasn't immune to the history. He wasn't insensible to what they were doing and where they were going. But at bottom, for him, it was a battle in the Cold War, and his goal was to go out there and sort of punch Russia in the nose and come home, and then he would consider his work done. Lovell flew, I think, as much for the sheer love of flight as anything else. All these guys love to fly, but as I always thought about Lovell, he was never quite so happy as when he was in space. And he was never quite so happy in space as when he was doing something just plain outrageous, like flying to the moon for the first time. I just think he loved being there. It's no coincidence that of all of the men he went into space the greatest number of times. Anders went just once, Borman went twice, Lovell went four times, and after Apollo 13, I swear he would have gone back for a fifth if he could have gotten to try a lunar landing again. Anders had made himself a sort of autodidact expert in the lunar module, and had the original flight plans gone as they were initially sketched out, he would have been the pilot of the LM, or the lunar module pilot in Earth orbit, and then later presumably in a lunar flight. The LM wasn't ready, so he was a lunar module pilot without a lunar module. Instead, he became the mission cartographer, the photographer, which was more than just putting together an album. It was scouting out landing sites, and he made himself very much an expert in lunar topography. He also was the man who was responsible for maintaining the life support systems in the spacecraft. So he flew, among those three, he flew as the closest thing to a pure engineer. Again, he knew he was making history, and to this day, he takes great joy and pride in the fact that he took the Earthrise picture, humanity's first true glimpse of its own world from the perspective of another world. And I think in the fullness of history, that's what's become the most meaningful aspect of the mission to him.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom, and we are talking to Time Magazine's Jeffrey Kluger. His book, Apollo 8, tells the story of the historic first mission to the moon in December of 1968. We'll be back after a short break. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's resume our conversation with Jeffrey Kluger from Time Magazine as we look back at the historic first mission to the moon, Apollo 8, in December of 1968. Before the era of the computing power we have now, the sheer audacity of how difficult it is to insert a spacecraft into orbit around the moon and hit that tiny target from such a long distance at the right velocity. That's not an easy thing to do, was it?
No, it's not at all an easy thing to do. And some of the numbers or just what it took was often described more by analogy than anything else. You know, Lovell, when he was first describing this to me, said, remember, we weren't aiming for the moon. We were aiming for where the moon would be in 3 days because it's obviously a moving target. So he said it's very much like hunters who are shooting at ducks. You lead the duck. You put your buckshot where, or you aim your buckshot for where the duck is going to be in a second or two, not where it is. In the case of this particular duck, they were traveling 233,000 miles to get there, and they had to come close enough to the moon that they could be snagged by its gravity, but not so close that they would be pulled in, which meant that they approached the moon from about, their goal was to get just 60 miles above the lunar surface. Now, on a scale of 233,000 miles to 60 miles, that is an infinitesimally small fraction. The analogy I used in the book was, it was like standing in one end zone of a stadium, firing at an apple at the other end, and aiming not to hit it, but just to skin it. A different analogy, a different metaphor somebody else used back then was, it's a little like trying to run past an onrushing locomotive from one side of the track to the other and snag a little sample of its paint as you went by it. Whatever it was, they had a very narrow miss distance and they had to navigate their way there somehow.
And then they have to make this fairly long, 4-minute engine burn to insert themselves into orbit. And that must have been a tense time.
It was a tense time. And here's why. It was just over 4 minutes they had to burn the engine. And as you say, they were trying to slow themselves down enough to be grabbed by lunar gravity because they were simply going too fast to orbit. Had they not slowed down, they just would have been whipped around again on that free return trajectory. And lunar gravity would have flung them home. The problem with slowing down is if you slow down too much, you crash, because then you slow down enough that not only are you not going to be, you're now going too slowly to be grabbed by lunar gravity for an orbit. Instead, you're just going to be dragged down to the surface of the moon. So as this engine is burning for 4.5 minutes, the guys, a couple of times, I think it was Lovell said, geez, 4 minutes, when they were only 2 minutes through it. And another one of them said, longest 4 minutes I've ever spent in my life. Because again, every second that engine was burning was a second that they were bleeding off velocity. And when you're flying in space, the key is keep moving and keep moving fast.
Well, and then the burn is successful. They're in orbit, but they still haven't seen anything. They're in orbit. The burn is successful. And in the book, you describe beautifully, for the first time, eyes, you know, organic, in this case, human eyes, see the far side of the moon. I was wondering if you'd read that passage for us from Apollo 8.
Sure. And this, as you say, the moon keeps one side of the Earth, one side faced to the Earth at all times. So human beings, animals, no one had ever seen, no living eyes had ever seen the far side of the moon. And I say when they got their first glimpse, all three men peered out. And at first, all three men said nothing. Nearly 4.5 billion years earlier, a passing protoplanet had collided with the infant Earth, knocking it to the cockeyed 23-degree conch that would one day give it its seasons. The collision sent up a great debris cloud that, for a short time, gave the planet a ring. Within a few eons, the ring coalesced into a moon. The new satellite would soon become gravitationally locked to the Earth, meaning that it would always keep one side facing its parent planet and the other side pointed out to space. Less than a billion years after the moon formed, the first one-celled organisms appeared on Earth. It would be another 2.5 billion years before multi-celled organisms, some with rudimentary light-sensitive eye spots, followed. And on dark nights, those spots may have registered the photons pouring down from the brightly lit moon. Later, other organisms with better eyes, and in one case, a mammal with a big brain and opposable thumbs, and a consuming curiosity about the nighttime sky, would come along. And in all of that time, not a single earthly eye had ever seen the side of the moon that the six eyes belonging to the astronauts in the Apollo 8 spacecraft were seeing now.
Wow. It's something you don't think about all these years later, but it's an awesome thought. A scary thought would be, you know, later on when they have to ignite that engine to come home, it's possible that if that had not have worked, that those astronauts would still be orbiting up there.
That's right. And that was one of the biggest concerns. There is always a concern about losing astronauts in space. You know, the Soviets lost an astronaut in Soyuz 1 in 1967. We had lost the Apollo 1 astronauts a few months earlier. So losing astronauts was always a risk. But losing astronauts that way, the idea that they might be trapped in lunar orbit, circling the moon forever because their engine had worked once well enough to get them into orbit, but it failed the second time and couldn't get them out of orbit. That was a scenario that really terrified NASA. As one of the astronauts' wives, Susan Borman, said when she was arguing, as it turned out futilely, against an orbital mission and arguing instead just for whipping around the far side and coming home, she said, if they get trapped, you will ruin the moon for everybody. Nobody will be able to look up at the moon again on an otherwise dark night and not think about the three men orbiting it.
Well, let's talk about the more pleasant parts, especially the Christmas Eve broadcast. Now, this isn't the first broadcast from the moon. That took place early in the early AM hours when they first went into orbit, as I recall. And in the book, you mentioned that most people in the United States are asleep, except maybe in Houston. But I was awake. I remember laying there in my jammies watching TV, and I remember those first pictures coming back from the moon.
Yeah, so do I. I was an adolescent then, and, you know, when you're an adolescent, you're supposed to be world-weary and cynical and disenchanted, and I just couldn't be. I was absolutely captivated, absolutely spellbound by it. The idea that we were seeing the moon from up close and the idea that we're seeing the Earth from a distance, that for the first time in human history, human beings had moved far enough away that the Earth could be contained in a window that was actually seen as a circle, as a sphere, instead of as the horizon below. That was a truly transformative, truly paradigm-changing shift in perspective.
And then, of course, there's the lovely Christmas Eve broadcast where each one of them describes what the moon looks like to them. And then they read from Genesis, which was just, to me, just so fitting on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, it was wonderfully lyrical. I mean, look, Genesis is verse. Genesis is its own kind of freeform poetry. So the words were beautiful to begin with and evocative and powerfully resonant. Even, you know, you don't have to be a person of faith. You don't have to believe in God to appreciate the imagery and the richness of the pictures that are being painted by those words. The thing about Genesis is, in some ways, it's its own freestanding poetry. You don't have to be a person of faith. You don't even have to believe in God to understand the lyricism in those words and the fact that they speak to something very primal, the beginning of all things. And, you know, you could not begin 1968 over again. You could not save the lives that had been lost. You could not have drawn back the blood that was shed, but you could redeem the year. And I think that may have been what touched people so much, that in a year in which there was so much rage, there was so much mortality, there was so much ugliness, that on Christmas Eve, people could still find a way to look at the Earth itself and at humanity itself and think maybe there is a renewal here. Maybe we can go on.
And as I recall, I think somebody even sent a telegram to NASA to the effect that, you know, you saved 1968.
That's right. You saved 1968. And I have looked at, when I was writing this book, I was fortunate to get my hands on the actual onion skin telexes that came from our Time magazine reporters in Houston up to New York, and that had rattled out of the teletype machine over the course of many days and were used to write the cover story, the Person of the Year cover story, in which Borman, Lovell, and Anders appeared on the cover. And on the last page of the last file, somebody took a red grease pencil and wrote a big heart and wrote "the end." And that, I think, captured, in a sense, for journalists here, it was this great capstone to a great mission and a great capstone to a terrible year. And I think it had that effect on everyone else in the country and in the world as well.
Well, and that's a great place to leave it. But before we do, I have one last question for you. It's about Frank Borman. When we last talked, you told me that he was still flying. And he was not just doing any flying, he was doing fire spotting?
That's right. When I first met him, I had met him before, but when I first sat down to interview him, it was in the summer of 2015, and we met in his hangar at the Billings, Montana airport, a spotlessly gleaming hangar that he maintains himself with his two airplanes that he flies himself. And the following year, I called him to ask him some follow-up questions. He was 88 at that point, reached him in his hangar, and he said to me, "Oh, it's a good thing you caught me now. About an hour ago, I was up flying a smoke spotting mission around Billings. It's fire season, so you want to keep an eye out for people." And I thought, this says it right here. This is how heroes roll. This is how patriots roll. This is how people who went to West Point and served in the military and are trained to serve their nation continue to operate, even in their late 80s on into their 90s. If there's something you can do to look out for your neighbors, you do it.
Well, we've been dealing with the most terrible fire in California history here, and there are many, many, many heroes from the sheriff of Butte County to the firefighters, first responders. Their stories are multitude. But that thought occurred to me. I thought about when I was going to talk to you. I thought about, you know, Frank Borman is still, you know, he's fighting fires up there in Montana, and I thought that's just such a wonderful poetic way to end this, is to think about that hero at 88 flying to help firefighters.
That's right. It they just never quit. As long as they can get from place to place, they will continue to serve. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, so's the book, Apollo 8. I highly recommend it. If you haven't read it, great time to read it right around Christmas, and a good gift to stick under the tree. Jeffrey Kluger, Time Magazine, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your, you know, incredible knowledge of what to me is probably the most epic of all the missions, although people will obviously argue that Apollo 11 is. Apollo 8 is just dear to me.
To me, too. And thank you so much for making the time. I really do enjoy chatting with you.
Thanks to our guest, Jeffrey Kluger, Time Magazine science writer and author of the book, Apollo 8. After a short break, we'll visit with one of the legendary flight controllers of the Apollo era, Glenn Lunny. Stay with us. Thank you. And we're back. We're now joined by retired NASA flight controller Glenn Lunny. Lunny was one of the lead flight controllers during the early days of the American Space Program and was there at Mission Control in Houston for the Apollo 8 trip to the moon in December of 1968. He joins us from his home in Houston. Glenn Lunny, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
And we are, of course, looking back at the 50th anniversary of my personal favorite flight, Apollo 8. And before we get to that, I'd like to, you know, just get to know a little bit about your background. I know you grew up in Pennsylvania in coal mining country. How did you go from there to becoming a flight controller?
That's a good question. Sometimes I look back on it and I don't believe it. I went to a school, University of Detroit, for my last 3 years after two in Scranton. But I was on a co-op program where I worked at a industry for 3 months, and then I went to school for 3 months. So it took me 5 years to get through college, but it was worth it because the chance that I had to work, especially, and it was at what was originally an NACA center, Lewis, in Cleveland, Ohio. I learned a lot of things, and I was there when Sputnik went up in 1957. I was in my fall of my last year, in the fall season of my last year. When I came back in the spring, coming in on in June, a lot had changed. The country had energized a manned space program. It was being done by a handful of people. Literally, there were 35 people around when they first chartered it that they were considered in it, and then they had some people from the other centers like me. There were 10 other centers, 10 other people that came from different centers. So I was there when it started, and it just felt right for me. At some point, George Lowe was the branch chief, and he asked me if I wanted to join because he was looking for people to join the Space Task Group down in Virginia. And I couldn't say yes fast enough when he asked me.
Apollo, you know, got off to a really rough start with the horrible, tragic fire that killed the astronauts Gus Grissom and Roger Chaffee and Ed White in 1967. And then the first time that the Apollo spacecraft flies is in October of 1968. And then this decision is made to send the very next flight to the moon with Apollo 8. And I'm wondering, from a flight controller point of view, if you could give us some background. What was it like to be, you know, told that that was what the next mission was going to be? What was the background there from your point of view of going from, okay, we've successfully test flown this spacecraft, and now we're going to the moon in December?
Well, let me answer it this way. Leading up to this, I had my other duties besides being a flight director were to run the branch, 30 some people, although it wasn't that many at that time. It was a branch that was doing the planning for flight controllers in the trajectory and guidance area. So the Apollo 8 flight was matched to the skill set that we had developed in the branch, and I carried over into my career as a flight director. But by the time of the fire, we made some changes, and I joined the flight director office in flight control division. And that's where I spent my time during most of the Apollo flights that I worked on. It was a remarkable turn. We had young people showing up. We came out of Gemini with probably, I don't know, 8 or 10 people at the most, probably less than that. And in the course of 1964, we upped the group in both 64 and 65, so that by the time we got to the Gemini flights and the Apollo flights, we had a group of people that had been together for, at least 2 years, and they were ready to take on the job. They really were. And Cliff Charlesworth and I moved over to the flight director office, and we were full-time occupied with that. And we left the branch to the people who were left. Jerry Bostic became the branch chief, and he helped steer it through the most exciting time that they had, and that was after the fire, planning to do the Apollo flights. And then in the course of events, Jerry and others were on scene as flight controllers down in the front row for the Apollo 7 and then the Apollo 8 flight. So they walked right into it, and on their second Apollo flight, second manned flight, we were going to the moon. And the men, you might think, had been stretched too far, but they were not. They jumped up to the task. And when they found out that the decision was being made to go to the moon on Apollo 8, I mean, they were as enthusiastic as can be. This was what they came to NASA for, was to get on with it. And God bless them. They did a wonderful job, and I happen to have a great job, too, going into Apollo 8 as one of the flight directors for that mission.
Do you remember the moment that you heard that the decision had been made that Apollo 8 was going to the moon?
When I was on for Apollo 7, and basically there was very little, there was no scuttlebutt about Apollo 8. And Apollo 7 went on, and we finally got to the landing. And I was walking out of the control center after the usual a closeout that you have for a flight. I was walking out with Cliff Charlesworth, and Cliff Charlesworth was my best friend in those days. And he took me aside and said, "Glenn," he says, "I want to tell you something that's coming." And he went through the story about the lunar module being late and the decision being made to go to, and this was, by the way, in the latter half of October. So by that time, it was there was a fair number of people who were involved in it, and it had plenty of scrubbing in the management level. But for us in the control center doing Apollo 7, they just isolated us away from that. Our job was to make Apollo 7 work as well as we could, and I think the management didn't want us to be distracted by thinking about the next flight as being one that would go lunar. So they didn't bother to tell us. I don't mean to say it that way. They chose probably deliberately not to involve the people in the control center in explaining that decision to them. But where the people who were in the know were fired up and doing everything they could to get everything that we needed to get ready to do Apollo 8.
Can you tell us about what your role was as a flight controller during Apollo 8? Were you there for most of it? What parts were you actually in the trench there at mission control or above it for?
Well, you know, when we do these things, we usually spend most of our waking hours somewhere around the control center. We tried, by the way, in Gemini, we had a sleep quarters in the building, and we thought we might use that, for three shifts. But we did it once or twice, and it just didn't seem to add anything to our abilities, and we were better off going home and seeing the family and checking in with them and telling them how it's going out there and so on. So we just didn't end up using the sleep quarters out at the center. We did our normal check of getting home and getting enough sleep so we're ready to go back on the next shift. So it it kept us busy, but the pathway to the lunar landing flight just seemed to be opened up for us by Apollo 8. It just felt like we were on a downhill run, and from then on out. And indeed, we were. This is what happened. Each one of the flights rolled off, Apollo 9, Apollo 10, and then the lead up to Apollo 11. And they all just rolled off relatively problem-free and completely in the way that we would have had them turn out. It was a great time, and everybody was rolling with it, ready to get to July and Apollo 11. But it was Apollo 8 that opened the door, opened the gate. We loved it. We loved it for that.
During the mission, one part I'd like to see if you could go back and remember what it was like, and I'm sure you can, but tell us from your point of view. I'm thinking about when the astronauts first insert themselves into lunar orbit and you lose signal, you have loss of signal as the spacecraft goes around the moon. And I recall reading about it, and I think it was Gene Kranz said it got very, very quiet there in Mission Control. And you could hear back then in the 60s, you know, everybody smoked, or lots of people did. And he said you could hear the hissing of all the Zippo lighters. It was just so quiet in there.
It's true. It's true. Although when we went behind the moon the first time, heading into the LOI burn, one of the things I relatively quickly said to the team was, okay, guys, why don't you take a break now, get out and do what you have to do, and get back, and we'll be ready to pick up on the other side. And a number of the guys sort of thought I was crazy to be getting off the console when we were waiting to see the vehicle emerge on the other side. But on the other hand, everybody needs a break now and then, and sometimes it's more necessary than others. And so I did do that, and they were just kind of surprised at it, and took advantage of it, I guess. Most of them had to do that, and they were back online, and the, if I can call it, shock of being told that they are free to go now was over, and they were back in plenty of time. The control center was really handy. There were restrooms around. Food was around. It was all close proximity, so it wasn't a big deal. And if anything were to happen, and when it's behind the moon, it's hard for us to know anything unless something happens with the ground equipment.
Yeah, because all you can see is just at that point, there's no information coming from the spacecraft, no data. All you can see is a clock. That's all you can watch.
Yeah, and you know, it was interesting. We did some things with the clock. We had a couple of clocks in MCC, and we designated one of them a clock that would be the first one to be triggered if we did not have any burn at all behind the moon, if for whatever reason we didn't have any burn at all. And then the other clock is running to the planned time of the burn, and it's it takes more time to deal with the fact that the spacecraft has slowed down and is going into orbit, and that was about, I think, about two minutes longer, I think, and that was the number. And when it came around the corner, we were really pretty frantically excited. We really were. And then we just fell right into our mode. You know, people always have this thing about, you know, how nervous you were, how uptight you were, or that questions of that ilk. But by the time we were doing this, we've been at it for 8 years. You know, being in the control center and being involved in the decisions affecting the flight. You know, being there for all the high points. Even if we weren't on shift, we were always there for the exciting things. I mean, we were all there when we landed on the moon. Most of the people, when we went into orbit around the moon this time, most of the people on all the other shifts were around, and then they went and got their sleep somewhere, and we're back on console and they're fine.
Well, and you guys are all really young then, too. The average age of the flight controllers was what, in the 20s?
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody told me that the average age when we landed on the moon of the flight controllers, not counting, you know, the PAOs or any of the doctors or any of those stuff, but not counting them, it was when we landed on the moon, it was about 27. Could have been 26, but might have been 27. It was an exciting time, and it was wonderful to see these young men. I'd hired a lot of them right out of college. They came to do Apollo. We had a lot of them working on Gemini. And Gemini had a real mission, by the way, besides long duration and besides learning how to deal with a digital spacecraft rather than an analog, which is what the Mercury capsule was. It had all that, but it was a special time. And we were hiring people. When we finished the Mercury flight, we probably had about 4 or 5 people that were qualified in the control center. We didn't use the term qualified because we didn't have a formal program to certify people, but we knew who was ready and who wasn't, and by and large, we did not have to drop anybody out of the pattern. There was a time when one or two fellows dropped off because they didn't like the work, or the work didn't suit them, or they didn't fit in with it, or it was not their bag. So we had a couple of people who left, and I say a couple, I can only remember one, so it probably was another one there somewhere. But all the people who came stayed with it, and they found their niche, and some of them didn't work a prime shift ever, but so be it. They did their job, and they helped the system out, and they covered some shifts that needed covering.
Speaking of prime shifts, I'd like to know what it was like for you to be there on Christmas Eve when the famous broadcast from the moon where the astronauts, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders, when they read from Genesis. Do you remember what it was like to be there watching that unfold?
It really was a wonderful thing. You know, the whole time we were there, I've come to call the control center, I call it our cathedral. And other people think of it as something different, but that was my sense of it. We were doing something spiritual when we did what we did, but especially when we went to the moon. It just seemed like, boy, you know, we're really doing something that's never been done before. It's a different place, and we have time here now, so we can actually do some exploring. And as Apollo went on, we did more and more of that. But it felt kind of spiritual that we, the human, was now operating in this place that was closest to us in the solar system. And we were doing something groundbreaking. We were doing something that people had never done before, although how many people had looked at the moon and wondered? Probably everybody who walked on the Earth. And we had a chance to be the generation that was able to help with the exploration of the moon itself. The whole time we were doing the lunar flight stay on the moon for a stay in the orbit around the moon on Apollo 8, it just seemed like it got more and more spiritual. I say that because coming up was the Genesis passages. And in a way, I just could not conceive of a better thing to have the crew say than what they did in reading from those passages. It just seemed like we were connected and we were doing something that had a spiritual content. In the control center, you could tell people were emotionally reacting to what was going on, and everybody had their own private way of dealing with it, I guess, but there were a lot of damp eyes in the control center, and people just enjoying the fact that here we were a part of this unimagined thing. I mean, when we started off, this going to the moon was impossible. And it turned out that, at least in our part of the business, a lot of young men came. They wanted to help with the Apollo program, and boy, did they help. They were just great.
Thanks again to our guests, retired NASA flight controller Glenn Lunny and Time Magazine's Jeffrey Kluger. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. Check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Subscribe to us on the NPR One app from NPR Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz, and our show is produced and engineered by Sky Schofield. I'm Dave Schlom, reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. To close the show, let's listen to the actual Christmas Eve message broadcast from the Apollo 8 astronauts, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders.
And for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and divided the light from the darkness.
And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And the evening and the morning were the second day.
And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place. And let the dry land appear," and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of